Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week, former Utah Attorney General John Swallow goes to court in a couple of weeks to face 14 felony counts, including a new money laundering charge. We'll hear more about the allegations and the witness list. Also, why does the state want to move the prison out of Draper? That's the question many citizens continue to ask, and the one lawmakers can't seem to shake. We'll find out why officials insist moving is the right call. And three, Salt Lake City Council members want more cops in East Side neighborhoods. We'll find out more and why City Police Chief Chris Burbank doesn't agree. The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got Boy Scouts, John Swallow, the prison move, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, senior political reporter Robert Gerke is with us. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
Investigative reporter Matt Canham is also with us. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Government reporter Chris Smart is in the studio. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Jennifer.
And editorial writer George Pyle is with us as well. Hi, George.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone from the Tribune newsroom, Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner is here. Hi, Jen.
Good morning.
And you can join us, too, with your questions and comments about the week's news. You can send those to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter. Put them online at sltrib.com, or you can call us 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Jennifer, I know you've got to get to it, so we'll start with you. The Boy Scouts of America made a pretty blunt statement about their policy concerning gay leaders. What happened?
Well, so Robert Gates, the national president of the Boy Scouts of America, was giving a speech yesterday at a national meeting in Atlanta, and he basically said that the current policy that allows for gay scouts but not openly gay scout leaders was unsustainable, and that the scouts needed to move to change that in order to basically direct their own future and avoid, you know, lawsuits that would decide for them who they are and what their standards can be.
And this has particular implications here in Utah because the LDS Church is the largest supporter of the Boy Scout organization, right? How did they respond to the statement?
Well, you're right. They are the largest. A lot of Boy Scouting is run through church-sponsored troops. The LDS Church has about 38,000 of those, and about 427,000 boys who participate in Scouts through Mormon Church programs. They have a wait and see response. They basically said, as they often do, we're going to look at this and study this and see, you know, where this goes. Now there are two general authorities who sit on the board of the Boy Scouts of America, so certainly they will be an active participant in shaping this conversation as it goes forward.
So what's at stake for the BSA as an organization?
Well, I think that what Gates really cited yesterday in his speech is that increasingly we see the passage of anti-discrimination laws around the country that sort of demand a level playing field for members of the lesbian and trans lesbian, gay, transgendered community. And the Boy Scouts have in the past been subject to lawsuits that have challenged their standards. And he does not think it's in their best interest to allow the courts to define them. He wants to be on the front end of that change. And we should remember that he is the former Secretary of the Defense. Under his leadership, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed for gay servicemen and women. So some might say this is not an unexpected move for him.
There have been those locally who have been pushing for gay leadership within troops. I believe you reported on someone who's tried to organize a Boy Scout troop for the Utah Pride Center.
Right. There was a conversation a couple of years ago about a Pride Center based troop that would be sponsored by the center and run through the center. That conversation went nowhere. The Great Salt Lake Council local councils of scouting have the authority to say yes or no if you want to open a new troop. And that conversation went nowhere. Peter Brownstein is a longtime scout leader and a scouting participant who was one in that group who led that fight. He said yesterday that he hopes that this will renew that conversation and give them a chance. He believes scouting is a great opportunity for lots of people, but notes for, you know, for all young men, but notes that many who disagree with policies on gay leaders have shied away and are missing out on a really important opportunity.
George Pyle, both organizations, both the BSA and the LDS Church, seem to be treading lightly on this one.
Well, they're having to figure out whether there's still a still a matter of standing on principle, or whether it's finally time to abandon the Alamo and move with the rest of society. Secretary Gates has said that it's not so much a matter of whether you think discrimination is a good idea or a bad idea. It's an idea that's over, and we need to get with the rest of the country. We had an editorial the other day mentioning that there are people here who want to survey Utah judges to see if they're members of organizations that discriminate. And 25 years ago, that would have been a country club that doesn't admit Jews or something. Now it's, are you a member of the Boy Scouts, where they discriminate against gay people? Mm. And in California, I believe the judges are already being told they can't participate with the Boy Scouts. Now, that's not what the Boy Scouts are all about. The Boy Scouts are supposed to be about people like judges and attorneys and doctors and airline pilots and things coming and being role models for young men. And if the traditional role models are now in a position where they say, well, sorry, I can't be in your club. I can't even, you know, I can't be an organizer. I can't be a leader. Maybe I can't even come and do the program because your organization discriminates. So Secretary Gates is saying we don't want to be in that position. He's setting it up in a way that would let local councils make their own decision to some degree based on community standards and what they want to do. So, but at least the Boy Scouts may be telling local councils that they may discriminate, but he's not going to tell them that they must.
Mm. And Jennifer, you said that the church issued a statement that was very noncommittal. I mean, did it say anything about if they're exploring scouting alternatives for the young men in their church?
Well, I think they do have other young men's programs. Whether or not they would reach a point where they think that it's better to just do that and not participate in scouting is something we can't know at this time. Of course, President Monson is a longtime advocate of the Boy Scouts, a longtime member of their board, been very active throughout the course of his life, and I think people often hear him refer to his time in the Scouts when he speaks at publicly. So I think it's hard to know what they're going to do. One thing I should say is that some of the people I talked to yesterday pointed out that the church already, in some ways, violates the existing BSA policy. Openly gay men who are chaste and are, subscribing to all tenets of the faith and are otherwise worthy to hold other callings have been and are called to serve in a role with scouting in their congregations. So in many ways, they're already doing this, whether that's widely publicly known or not, I can't say, but it does happen. And so what Gates is proposing might move the scouts as a whole more in line with what is already being done in practice here.
Mm. And Jennifer earlier mentioned the anti-discrimination laws that are being passed in other mm-hmm. states. In Utah in particular, the Boy Scouts got an explicit carve-out from the anti-discrimination law that was passed by the legislature this past session. It specifically says the Boy Scouts are exempt from that. But in other states, it's not as clear-cut. And so that's what where these come into play.
Mm. Jennifer, where does the discussion go from here? Did Gates give a timetable on when the BSA will make a decision? Did the LDS Church give indication of when it will take an official policy position?
No, neither is the short answer. Of Gates, there's no change imminent. There's nothing specific proposed for discussion or voting at this annual meeting that they're having. But I think it'll be a conversation that we see play out over the next year. And I don't know all the details of their process, but I would guess it would take another annual meeting, action by their board, So I would say we'll see something happen in the next year.
Jennifer Dobner of the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, you can join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's move on to another top story this week. We learned more about the criminal charges former Utah Attorney General John Swallow will face at an upcoming hearing. And Robert, tell us about the revisions.
Well, so previously he'd been facing 12 felonies and 2 misdemeanors. His preliminary hearing is coming up beginning June 8th and running through the week. The prosecutors amended the charges slightly. They dropped one of the they dropped a misdemeanor charge that was failing to disclose a conflict of interest, and added a money laundering charge. Now, it's a little unclear what exactly the money laundering charge refers to. All we really know is that it was something that happened between 2010 and 2012. So before he took office, it would have been during the campaign time or when he was working on the Mark Shurtleff campaign. But it alleges that he knowingly took or received proceeds from an illegal activity and used them in another activity. Throughout the charging documents, they're vague. There's a narrative laid out, and then there's a series of charges, and so it's not exactly clear what they're referring to, where the money came from, and that supposedly was laundered. But it does add another felony. So now instead of 12 and 2, he's facing 13 felonies and 1 misdemeanor. We'll find out a little bit more about this beginning June 8th when his preliminary hearing starts, and the prosecutors have to lay out explicitly what they allege has been done to see if he can, if the judge determines that he needs to stand trial.
Certainly this gives a little bit more shape to the case that John Swallow will face.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, here we are just barely, a week, almost 2 weeks from the preliminary hearing beginning, and the charges are still sort of evolving, I guess you could say. But I think we're at a point now. The other thing that they did the other day was release the witness list. So we have 33 names of people who are going to be testifying at the preliminary hearing. And we can go through those if you want. But the idea being that they're kind of, it is solidifying and it is sort of taking shape, and we're going to start seeing we're going to start seeing the prosecutor's case laid out more clearly when that preliminary hearing begins.
Give us some of the highlights. You don't need to go through all 33, but who's on the list and who's noticeably not on the list?
Let's start there. Noticeably not on the list is Mark Shurtleff. I think his attorney would probably object to him having to testify, you know, since he's still also facing charges himself. Jason Powers, the campaign manager, campaign consultant, who was under some, you know, under some pressure in a little bit of hot water earlier, is not on the list. On the list, you know, you've got the sort of the cast of usual suspects: Jeremy Johnson, the St. George businessman who sort of made the allegations that sparked this whole thing. You've got Mark Jensen, who's the convicted businessman who entertained Shurtleff and Swallow in Pelican Hill down in Newport Beach. You've got people like Kirk Torgensen and Scott Reed who are in the attorney general's office, Kirk is no longer in the attorney general's office, but were some of the top officials in the attorney general's office at this time. You've got sort of the FBI agents, Michelle Pickens and John Isaacson, who were investigating this, and then the Scott Nesbitt, who's the state investigator, and you've got some of the campaign staff from that Swallow campaign, people like Seth Crossley and Renee Cowley and Jessica Fossen. So there's a long list of people. It's unclear how many of them will actually testify. These are sort of optional people who may testify. So we'll see how it shakes out once the prosecution starts presenting their case. It's not Swallow's attorneys will do some cross-examination. John will, the former attorney general, will not be on the stand, and his attorney will not actually present a defense, but there will be some cross-examination.
Mm-hmm. George, from the opinion page, mm-hmm. What will you be looking for? What would you be listening for during this preliminary hearing?
The big thing to me is how much of the case against John Swallow is based on testimony from people who are already in a lot of trouble. I have always been really suspicious of, you know, jailhouse snitches and things like that who are obviously there testifying against this guy to try and get their own sentences reduced or you know, right out of Chicago. And so if it's just the crooked or allegedly crooked businessmen who are showing up and saying he done it, then in my mind, that's kind of a weak case. And I think before a lot of the public, that might be kind of a weak case. But we also have FBI agents, current and former attorney general's office staff and attorneys, people who have other who have investigated this from a professional point of view. So if the case, if they've got evidence, if they've got paper trails, if they've got things to say, then the case becomes much stronger, both, I think, in court and in the court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm. And George makes a good point. I mean, I think, you know, you've got Jeremy Johnson, who I think is facing 7 dozen federal counts. You've got Mark Jensen, who's going to have to be dragged down from the Davis County Jail. You've got, you know, you've got a guy like Aaron Christner, who's been charged with fraud. You've got a guy like Jonathan Eborn, who's run into federal issues with federal regulators and a business he was running. So these are the people who are they're building the case on, and their credibility can be impugned by the, you know, the fact that, you know, a lot of them are facing jail time or have served jail time before.
You mentioned that Swallow's predecessor, Mark Shurtleff, mm-hmm. will not be testifying, but he's also facing charges of his own. What's the status in his case?
They're still working on the scheduling on that one, and I think there was I can't remember exactly what day they moved his preliminary hearing to there, but there was an order yesterday, I believe, postponing his preliminary hearing. it was originally scheduled to begin fairly soon, and I think it's been rescheduled, and I don't remember what date. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So June 8th is when Swallow's preliminary hearing
yeah, 5 days.
Starts. Yeah, walk us through the process.
Well, you know, basically what it is it's our first chance to really see the case that the prosecution has put together. And so it begins June 8th. It'll go, you know, right through Monday through Friday, and we'll, you know, we're anticipating it'll be full days. They'll call these witnesses, and they'll present their case. There will be, like I said, cross-examination, and at the end of it, the judge will decide whether the case the prosecution's put out is strong enough to make him stand trial. Now, it's sort of a low bar, so the expectation generally is that, you know, you'll be bound over to stand trial. But, you know, if the case falls apart, it could, you know, it could just kind of crumble before our eyes and he could walk free. But yeah, so at the end of it, they'll decide if he's going to stand trial. He'll set a trial date, which will probably be quite a ways down the road because there's a lot of preparation that needs to go into that. And then we'll see where it goes.
And you'll be watching, and we'll be
We'll be watching. Yeah, watch sltrib.com. We're going to be doing real-time updates and tweeting and all of that great stuff to kind of keep people up to date on it.
Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke is with us. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us too, 801-355-TALK, or send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and joining me today, George Pyle, Robert Gerke, Chris Smart, and Matt Canham. And you can join us too, 801-355-TALK is that number. Another huge story this week was the prison relocation. Very controversial. State officials held their first information meeting this week in Salt Lake City. And there's a pesky question, Matt, that proponents wish would go away. There's a theme that people kept bringing up in these meetings. What was it?
Why don't we just leave the prison in Draper?
Now, What's the answer?
State leaders are adamant. The decision's been made. We are not leaving the prison in Draper. We are finding a new site. They have narrowed the list to 5 sites, including one about 5 miles west of the airport. That's what this meeting was supposed to be about. And what this meeting had, you had a panel of people who were working on moving the prison, and you had a moderator who looked through questions from the audience and posed them to the group. And about every third or fourth question was, are you sure you don't want to leave it in Draper? Can't we just rebuild in Draper? And you'd watch as this panel would get increasingly frustrated. It's not going to go away. And I think one part that's very interesting here is you have this group of lawmakers who are saying, we're going to make this decision based off of science and reason. We're going to look in the ground and see where we can build. And we're going to decide this for what's, you know, the technical merits. And the public's like, but it's still a political decision. At the end of the day, you're still going to vote on it. And because of that, we can still stop this. And they're right. Now, here's where it's going to be hard. You actually have to get enough state lawmakers to say, yeah, I agree with you, and we're not going to move the prison. You had a handful, who were really adamant during the session. And you had a group, you know, there was both some Democrats and some Republicans who voted against the bill that actually funded this move. But that group does not appear to be growing. And so essentially you have communities who don't want the prison arguing with people who are very adamant that the prison's moving. And so it creates this tension that I don't think is going away.
Well, you said the panelists were frustrated. What about the mood in the room? What about those who were attending? There were a couple hundred, right?
Yeah, there were a couple hundred people, and all of the people around me were muttering under their breath continuously through the explanations of why it's not moving. And so I'll go through a couple of those reasons. The state doesn't want to leave it there because they say it's too hard to rebuild on the site. There's 680 acres out in Draper where the prison site currently is. If you look at it from an aerial view, it looks like there is plenty of land to rebuild the prison on site. But the state says some of that's not buildable. I don't know which acres those are. They also say it's inefficient. You'd have to essentially build a building, move some inmates into it, tear down a building, clean it out, and then replicate that throughout the process. So it'd take longer to build. But essentially what it comes down to is the topic that some of the prison relocation people don't like to talk about very much is they look at the land in Draper as too valuable to keep as a prison. It's right off of I-15. It's in an area where there's a lot of high-tech growth. They'd rather have high-tech growth there and move the prison out near the airport or in Grantsville in Tooele County or in Eagle Mountain in Utah County where there isn't a lot of growth in those areas near these sites. And use this for a better purpose. There, you know, another reason that Representative Brad Wilson, who's the co-chair of the commission, brought up that had people roll in their eyes was that you don't want a prison that close to an interstate, which had people, the person next to me said, I haven't heard that in the last 50 years. Like, you know, like it's been there for a long time, right next to an interstate the whole time. So really, there, you know, there's a struggle in explaining, but it comes down to dollars.
Quickly remind us about the short list of sites. You mentioned that there's a Salt Lake City site out by the airport. You took a field trip with officials last week to see these in person. What did you see?
I saw cows and sagebrush. They're all agricultural land at the moment. I saw some antelope, too. It's very pretty. But they're all agricultural. You know, the one near the airport, you can see the skyline in the distance. You can see the FAA tower in the distance. And near you are some industrial buildings, but they're not that close. They got to find some land that is close enough to that's buildable and not touching wetlands. That's the challenge near the airport. The next meeting is going to be May 28th, and that's going to be in Tooele County. And there's two sites there. There's one next to the what's now called the Miller Motorsports Park, which I don't know what it will be now that the Millers are trying to get out of that. And that's right next to a recreation center. And you turn on the street and you see the little kiddie swimming pool and the slide that goes down into it and the little soccer fields. And then across the street is supposed to be the land under consideration for a prison. And then the other one in Tooele County is behind where the Walmart distribution center is. I asked them if Walmart has a problem with that. And when they met with Walmart officials, their only concern is they didn't want the prison to steal their employees to work at the prison. So
interesting.
That was their concern. The other two are out in northern Utah County on the west side of Utah Lake. And Eagle Mountain, which is a pretty fast-growing city, has about 25,000 people now. But it's a valley that's a lot like the Salt Lake Valley. It can stretch a long ways. And so they're looking at a site that's miles away from where homes are now. That does not mean the people who live there are saying, well, this is going to fill in with homes. And so that's a concern. And the last one's even west of that in a little teeny Fairfield, where I'm told the two main businesses are a warehouse for fireworks and an airstrip where they make small one-person planes.
Okay.
So those are the five sites.
George, it's early days, but do you have a prediction? Where will this new prison be built?
Oh, boy, I'm not going to call that. I mean, I think as we sit
you
here
got a
right
20%
now,
chance. Come on.
I would bet on one of the Tooele County sites just because the airport site is too close to wetlands and could get into all kinds of environmental issues, and Salt Lake City really doesn't want it there. I had been thinking that they might yet leave it in Draper, but it looks like the legislature is just absolutely determined not to do that. They are in a little bit of a catch-22 because they're saying, we don't want it in Draper because Draper land has a higher and better use. And then they go to all these other places and they say, oh, it's no problem living next to a prison, working next to a prison. Prisons are nice. And especially modern prisons, the ones the director of Department of Corrections and other people, they've been around the country. They've looked at state-of-the-art prisons. They brought us slides and pictures and captions and arrows and circles and captions on the back. They don't look like prisons. They look like government buildings. They look like they might even be a school. You know, from the road you can't tell. And they're fences, but they're not quite the 15-foot fences with rows of razor wire. So they're not as depressing as the kind of prison we're used to seeing, and that's on purpose. That's not just for the benefit of the neighbors. That's for the benefit of modern rehabilitative programs, where you're understanding that most of the people who go into prison are coming out again, maybe in just a couple of years, maybe longer, and you need to do something while they're there to address their mental health issues, their substance abuse issues, their life skills issues, and turn them back to society better than when they came in. And the current thinking is that a campus with that is less oppressive and more designed to help people is better for the prisoners, for the staff, and for the surrounding area. And we had a story this morning that a lot of the good government and human rights organizations are basically saying, now, fine, wherever, I mean, it should be close to the Wasatch Front so you don't have to drive miles to get there or for the volunteers to get there. But we're more interested in what it is, not where it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, I think pretty rationally, if the way to get what we want, which is a modern prison that is focused on rehabilitation, if the way to get that is to offer the legislature the chance to redevelop the Draper site as the next Adobe or a bunch of Walmarts or whatever it is, fine. That's fine. We'll take it. And that does seem to be where it's going.
Matt, in the public information meeting, did that question or that issue come up of rehabilitation versus where it goes? I mean, did the criminal justice reform aspects of a new prison come up?
Yeah, people are interested in this, and I think it's one of those rare issues where you might put people, partisan people, on different sides of an issue, and really everyone's in agreement that our prison does not help inmates or nudge inmates towards not recidivizing. You know, it's can be a rough situation out there where there's not a lot of space for treatment, not a lot of vocational training. So they end up spending years there, come out, and they are in a far worse personal situation than they were when they went in. And so what are they going to do? You have the Department of Corrections agrees with that. The legislature agrees with that. These activist groups and human rights groups agree with that. And so, you know, that's part of how they're selling it is this is a prison that should be the exact same size as our current prison, but is built for long-term growth. And how they're going to do that is they're going to reduce the number of people who are on drug charges or put in prison, and hopefully get treatment for people who are in prison, who have drug problems, who have mental illness issues, and make it so they don't come back.
Well, one of the things that Matt just mentioned is they're building this new prison the same size as the old one, which is interesting because they're continually having to go out to these county jails and put people in
right.
county jails, and the county jails really don't have the programming that the state prison does. And so if they're focusing on rehabilitation, as George says, and as the prison officials say, that creates an issue where, you know, why not build it a little bigger, actually have the programming there on site instead of continuing to rely on these county jail beds where the inmates aren't necessarily getting the sex abuse treatment and the substance abuse treatment that they might otherwise need to keep from being recidivist.
But is the theory that there will be fewer prisoners going forward if we do this rehabilitation?
I think they're trying to bend the curve, but the curve is still going up.
And realistically, this is a political decision. You need legislators to vote for a new prison. If you made it a big prison that took the inmates from the county jails, you'd have lawmakers in these counties saying, my county relies on that money.
Hmm.
I can't support this. So I think what's happening is they're punting that issue, which is mm-hmm. a legitimate issue, to another day. And they're trying just to do a heavy lift of finding a place to build a new prison. And they will, you know, continue to debate the county jail issue for probably years to come.
Okay. Location, location, location. Meetings are not over yet. You said there's another one coming up next week?
Yes, May 28th in Grantsville at the high school there. It's from, they have an open house at starting at 4. The question and answer starts at 7. The group that opposes the prison, which includes the mayor and the county commissioners there, are holding a food truck rally at the exact same time to try to lure people to their more fun event than going to an open house where you could talk to, you know, the people trying to argue on behalf of moving the prison. So
okay.
It should be a festive environment.
Indeed. Okay, we'll continue to watch that one. Let's move on to the capital city. It's budget time in the capital city, and the Salt Lake City Council wants more cops, particularly in the parks and on the east side of the city. What's going on, Chris?
Well, that's what we're hearing. It's budget time, and this is where the rubber meets the road for taxpayers. The budget is $254 million. It comes in a document that's hundreds of pages long, and it's pretty daunting. But one of the things that the East Side City Council members said this past week was, we want more cops in our neighborhood. The number of police has not shrunk, but with the new sort of management at Salt Lake City Police Department, which is a flexible one, where the officers go where they're needed. And they're more needed downtown and in the Pioneer Park area. If you look at a map of where all the crimes are committed in Salt Lake City, that's where they are. They're downtown, around the Pioneer Park area. So over the last 2 years, the police have moved more of their officers down there to meet the need. This was done because there was a lot of uproar from business and residents in the area saying things are really going downhill around Pioneer Park. And so now the East Siders are going, well, hey, you know, we need cops here too. And they had grown fond of bicycle patrols in their neighborhood. Because those officers are, you know, they're right there. You can talk to them. They are down in the parks when they are present. The sort of seedier looking characters seem to melt away and people feel good. But now they're not feeling so good.
Well, interestingly, the police chief, Chris Burbank, he believes the staffing is just fine. He thinks this flexible policing is working.
Yes, he does. And so that was sort of surprising. I mean, it's one of the first times when I've been sitting in a budget hearing when the council saying, and we're going to give you more people and more money. And the director is saying, no, we don't want it, you know. So that was interesting. But Burbank made some good points this week in talking to the council. One of them was that there's a drunk in Fairmont Park, okay. And so the Sugar House residents are going, oh my gosh, there's a drunk in Fairmont Park. We don't want to even go to the park. And so they call the cops. The cops come and get the drunk. They take him down. They book him in jail. Next day he gets out, goes back to the liquor store and Sugar House, buys a bottle, gets drunk in Fairmont Park. So what the chief is saying, what we need is intervention, not jail time. So let's take that guy, let's get him in a program, and now we don't have to arrest him every day. So let's spend our money on that rather than us trying to arrest our way out of these social problems.
But does the city do that kind of social intervention?
Not as much as Burbank would like. And the fact of the matter is that...
Like, who would do that? A social worker?
Yes.
Right now, a cop does that.
Cops do it. There are homeless service providers who do it, who try to do it. But Salt Lake County has funding for that. But you don't see a city government outreach to do that. You do have nonprofits that try to do that, but the system is such that right now, you know, take these guys, just put them in jail. They're back out. And the chief says that they have arrested some of these same folks hundreds of times, and it doesn't stop the problem. That said, the people on the east side would like some security. They'd like to know that there's a cop in the neighborhood, and they're complaining that response times have grown from minutes to hours. The fact is, if there's a violent crime in your neighborhood, the police will come fast. But if there's a property crime, a burglary or something, you know, it could take hours for them to come. So the East Siders are feeling unprotected.
Okay, well, that's an issue that will continue during the budget process.
It certainly will.
In other budget news, the mayor has a huge agenda. He is proposing a 6% budget increase, and some city council members worry that they might be spending money that the city won't have long term. What's going on?
Well, so the general fund this year is the mayor's proposing a budget of $254 million. Last year's budget was about $230. But it's not a $24 million bump. They're just doing the accounting a little bit differently with the RDA. But it is a $14 million bump. That's about a 6% growth rate. The city council is looking at that and saying, is this for real? I mean, how are you projecting that we're growing this much? And so, you know, the mayor's budget staff is coming back and saying, well, you know, sales taxes are up. We have new growth. The economy is rebounding, and so folks are going to pay their property tax on time this year. And so that is going to bump this up. So the council is not taking issue with whether that money will come in this year, but whether they're asking is this a trend or is this just a bump? And if a one-year bump, the problem comes that if they spend all the money this year, then most likely they're going to have to spend at least as much next year. And if this is a one-time thing, it's going to, a year from now, it may cause a tax increase. And so with this kind of projected growth, they have to do a truth in taxation hearing, which will come in the coming weeks, and they'll have to explain to the public that if we spend all this money, your taxes could be going up next year. But nobody knows for sure.
George Pyle, does any of this smell like election year politics? Well, the mayor's up. Some council members are up.
Well, I mean, was it last year? The council thought the mayor didn't propose a big enough budget. They went for a bigger budget and a tax increase.
2 years ago.
2 years ago, because they thought he didn't want to spend enough money. We had all what the real estate agents call the deferred maintenance issues in the parks and the roads and things like that. And they said, look, we need to spend more money. Now, a lot of that was on, because it's deferred maintenance, that's capital. It's arguably one time. And so if you don't have the money next year, you just don't fill as many potholes or you don't plant as many trees, you don't have to lay anybody off. And now it's the mayor who wants to spend more money. Because of the projected revenue, he doesn't have to increase taxes, at least on paper, to do it. But now, especially when you're able to say, I will spend more money and I don't have to raise your taxes now, then the mayor might be thinking, well, that looks good. I'm going to give everybody more stuff without having to raise their taxes, because everybody always wants more stuff, but nobody wants to pay for it. I'm able to do that. I'm a magician. And the council is saying, well, yeah, you can do it this year, but can you do it next year? And then, of course, if revenue is flat, you might be able to do it next year. But if it goes down, and that's really hard to predict, especially when a city that's as dependent as ours is on sales tax, you can have real hills and valleys with that. So, yeah, everybody wants to be able to pull a rabbit out of a hat of saying, I will give you, the citizens, more things, more police, more smooth roads, but don't worry, I don't have to raise your taxes. Everything's fine.
The budget, not a very sexy topic, but one that has true implications for people's lives. So I'm sure that you'll continue to keep a real close eye on that, Chris.
Indeed, we will.
All right. We're talking about the week's news. We invite you to chime in. 801-355-TALK is our number. We need to take another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce in studio with the Salt Lake Tribune's George Pyle, Robert Gerke, and Christopher Smart and Matt Kahneman. You can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. We did have interim legislative meetings this week. And Robert, can you just hit some of the highlights?
Yeah. So what they do is they gear up for the session by having these meetings during the summer. And so they're just sort of kind of getting the ball rolling on some of the bigger issues, things like the medical marijuana bill. They're starting discussions on that to decide, you know, how they want to revise that to bring it back next session. There's an issue still hanging out there with this Tesla dealership that can't open because state law prohibits them from manufacturers from selling directly to customers, and so they're trying to negotiate an agreement with that with the existing auto dealers who are afraid they're going to be cut out of the equation. There's some discussions taking place on police body cameras that are kind of getting underway. And so some of these big issues are just sort of kind of beginning to form, and they're going to be discussing them over the next several months, and then we'll see them presumably fully grown and ready to harvest come the legislative session in January.
This Tesla one is pretty interesting because they already invested in a showroom that they can't use.
Yeah.
And one of the committee, I think it was the committee co-chair, sort of hit him hard on that point. Like, why did you do this?
Yeah. The vice president for their regulatory affairs person said that they had received verbal assurances from state regulators that, yes, they would be able to open, that they do comply with the law without having a sort of a franchise in place. But then when a week before their grand opening, after they'd invested $3 million to build this showroom and, you know, get it all up and ready to go, they got told by the attorney general's office, well, sorry, you actually don't comply with the state law and you can't open because you have to have a franchisee dealer in place between you and the customer. So that's what they've been trying to work on. There was a bill last session. It didn't make it out of the House because of concerns, again, from the manufacturers and the dealers. And so those are the parties who are kind of trying to hammer this thing out. The representative of the Dealers Association said he thinks that they're getting close, but wouldn't really kind of give us an idea of what exactly they're you know, envisioning in terms of this agreement. One of the representatives, Representative Wilson, said that the governor's indicated that if they do come to an agreement, it could be a special session issue because we still have the special session planned for August or September for the Medicaid expansion, whatever they manage to work out there. That's another issue that's still just sort of kind of moving very slowly through the works.
Okay. We've got time for our final segment, our underplayed story of the week, story that will continue to build as we continue to watch. Matt, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the story that I actually wrote late last night and rushed it into the paper today. There's a conservative group called the Club for Growth that focuses on fiscal issues, and they tend to bully Republicans to vote to their side of the issue. They don't go after Democrats as much as their own. And they, on Wednesday, said they were going to spend $1 million hitting Representative Rob Bishop and Representative Chris Stewart for not opposing the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank, which really quickly is a longtime government program that helps companies compete overseas. And Republicans, far-right Republicans, say it's the government manipulating the free markets, they want it killed. Bishop and Stewart wouldn't say anything about it, so they were going to get $1 million of ad spend against them. And then on Thursday, they both opposed it. And so Friday, here we are, and the ad campaign is not going to happen. It's an example of how money in politics actually works. And both members of Congress declined to comment about their reasoning for the timing of their position. But, you know, it seems kind of clear that these are two very conservative lawmakers who are not don't have to worry about a challenge from their left, but they could be challenged from a Republican on the right. So this is what this group kind of focuses on and feasts on, is pushing people to the right, and it looks like it worked in this case.
Interesting. That's at sltrib.com today. Chris Smart, what you got?
Speaking of taxes, something hanging out there that could be on the November ballot. This goes back to it actually goes back to golf and Glendale golf course, which the city wants to repurpose into a multi-use public park. In order to make that happen, they have to find some money. So they were thinking about a bond, but they knew if they just bonded for Glendale that the rest of the town might not favor such a thing in the ballot box. So the administration, Ralph Becker, has embarked upon a campaign. They're going to have at least 8 town meetings, and they're asking everybody in Salt Lake City what they would like in ways of new recreation amenities, parks, trails, anything, et cetera. And so it looks like, and we don't know the amount, but it looks like there would be, will be, a bond on the ballot this November asking residents if they want to increase their property taxes for better recreation.
Taxes. Okay. I'm going to keep an eye on that one. Gerke, what you got?
Just quickly, this happened yesterday as well. Utah Supreme Court Justice Jill Parrish was confirmed to the federal bench. She had been nominated before. The Senate couldn't get her nomination through the process before the end of the last Congress, so the president renominated her, and she was confirmed yesterday. This means two things, I guess. We have another highly qualified woman on the federal bench, and two, we have another vacancy for Governor Gary Herbert to fill on the Utah Supreme Court. His last pick, Dino Jimenez, was, coasted through pretty easily. These things take a little bit of time, but now he's going to have another vacancy to fill on the Utah Supreme Court.
And as Raleigh pointed out in his column, Jill Parrish's vote was actually scheduled for Wednesday, but it was filibustered by Rand Paul's and our very own Mike Lee. Yeah. Okay, George Pyle.
Okay, while Utah waits for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide on the same-sex marriage case, and they argue about whether this is the sort of thing that should be imposed by judicial fiat, in Ireland today they are voting on it. You know, the most Catholic country in the world, maybe even more so than Italy, it's on the ballot to allow gay marriage in the Constitution. The early polls showed it had a good chance of success, but recent polls in Great Britain have been really bad, and even the polls now are showing it tightening. So then you get the question, okay, if it's approved by plebiscite, that means it's accepted, right? So the court should go for it. Or it might mean it gets accepted by plebiscite, so the courts don't have to order it. The courts can stand aside and let the political process run its course. So, and we know that despite the fact that he's told he shouldn't, Justice Kennedy will look around the world for what other smart people are doing, and that may or may not affect how the court rules.
Very good. I just wanted to point out something on the medical marijuana. There have been the committee that is considering medical marijuana is scheduling 2 sessions at least during the summer in the interim sessions, which I thought was pretty interesting on the topic. And a group of activists are planning a whole series of community meetings to talk about it. And they have held their first one this week up at Weber State. So that's something to...
And the governor has indicated that he's
open to it with certain conditions. Lots and lots of news to watch, and we're watching it. George Pyle, Robert Gerke, Chris Smart, Matt Canham. Thank you all, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you. Happy Memorial Day.
And we'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby reveals Sonny, his friend's macabre hobby of recycling roadkill.
Like me, he gets bored very easily. And when he starts seeing stuff on the road, dead stuff, he'll stop and collect it to make stuff out of.
Stuff.
You know, like wallets and wristbands and things like that.
Some people scrapbook. Sonny likes to
some people
get roadkill and make and something
that's
creative.
Right. And Sonny likes to kill scraps.
Well, you wrote a column about this experience. You must read a little bit.
We were driving down the road and Sonny slammed on the brakes suddenly, and I was dozing, so it scared me. And turns out that he'd seen this snake in a road. And this was in 2011, and I wrote, "When we got out of the truck, the snake was coiled on the edge of the road like it was trying to hitchhike. It's hard to tell with snakes because they don't have thumbs. This one didn't have a head either. Whoever ran over it just minutes before had stopped and removed that part and the rattles. But as you might expect with snakes and or Congress, it was still trying to conduct business as usual. It twitched and writhed on the warm asphalt. Sonny didn't care about the head or the rattles. He wanted the snake skin to make something. Either a hat band for himself or lingerie for his wife. He got mad when I tried to pin him down on which one."
Now, this column caught the eye of some reality TV producers.
Yeah, about a week after this ran, I got an email from a company in Hollywood that puts together reality show proposals and then shops them around Hollywood to see if anybody would bite. And they liked the idea of two idiots driving around the country collecting roadkill. And on this particular road trip, we'd collected a lot. I mean, parts of deer. He'd cut the tail off of a couple of coyotes. There were all of these were from dead things who no longer had need of them. And Sonny just hated seeing them go to waste. And it was like an Easter egg hunt in hell. It was. He would collect anything as long as it didn't smell too bad. At one point, we hit a buzzard that was lifting off roadkill, just bumped it. And Sonny was disappointed because he said, I could have used those feathers. But this company wanted to do it. So they sent up somebody to interview us, and we met him at the Grand America and sat down for an interview and some video footage. And Sonny and I got into a violent argument over it, but they were still interested after that and sent a camera crew up to Utah and followed us around for a while we did stupid stuff, put together this sizzle reel promoting this roadkill reality show. It didn't end up going anywhere, which is good because I got other things to do than drive around and collect dead stuff.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find a lot more Kirby on the archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a safe Memorial Day weekend, and we'll be back next week.